As I indicated there, I want us tonight to look at the prophecy of Zephaniah, and especially just this first chapter. Now, the reason I want to do it in this way is that with Zephaniah, there are no new themes, ideas, or concepts brought before us. Zephaniah is restating much of what we've heard in the past, especially what we heard when we were looking at Haggai, as Haggai brought a word of judgment to God's people. So the same ministry is engaged in with Zephaniah here, bringing a word of judgment, of repentance, and ultimately of grace to God's people also. And for that reason, because it's repeating these things we've heard already, we could possibly do it in one single study. But I want to avoid doing that, because that would pack too much into a single study. But especially I want us to think of what Zephaniah is saying at verse 15 and to the end, where he is treating the day of the Lord being near. And I want us to think of what that is, means and its significance for Zephaniah, for the people of his day, and for ourselves also. The three chapters of Zephaniah, the first chapter is a chapter of judgment, the second is a chapter calling them to repentance, and the third chapter is a chapter which describes the rejoicing of the Lord when his people do rejoice and return to him. The context of this passage is, well, if we can go back rather to Sunday past when we were thinking of Isaiah 38, and we were thinking there of the experience of Hezekiah. Hezekiah was the sole king ruling from 715 through to the year 686. After Hezekiah, and we all know these names, but sometimes we find it difficult to link them all together. But after Hezekiah, there came Manasseh. Now, Manasseh's rule was over 50 years. In fact, he is the longest serving king of both Israel and Judah. And yet a king who brought havoc and wrought fearful and terrible things upon Judah and Jerusalem before he was brought to see these things by God's grace. After Manasseh, there came Amon, and he ruled for just 2 years. And tying together Manasseh and Amon, that was a period of fairly long, dark, and silent days. So we have Hezekiah, Manasseh, Amon. And again, to tie in another name that we're all very familiar with, we think of Josiah. We all think of and mention and remember the reformations and the effects of Josiah's reign and the establishment of the worship of God again. Well, Josiah is the fourth in that link. He came to the throne as an eight-year-old. He was a contemporary of the prophet Jeremiah. He came in the most inauspicious of circumstances. Idolatry was rampant in his society. But Josiah was guided well. He started to repair the house of God. While he was doing so, or at least while he instituted that, those who were busy doing the work found a book. The book of the law of Moses. As they read and as Josiah read that book, he realized the faults that were in the nation and with society. And he immediately sought to put them right by reinstating Passover and some of the feasts and festivals that are mentioned there. Go back to 2 Chronicles chapter 34 and you find it set out there for you. That's the day we're told of then, when Josiah was the king, that Zephaniah was the prophet. The reason why I mention it just now, simply because I don't know if it's a particularly Highland tradition, but it is certainly a worthwhile tradition. When you've got an old Bible that is possibly the pages are falling apart and it's, to our judgment, beyond our usefulness. I've known it done, I've done it myself, and others have said it as well. You don't throw that Bible away, but you wrap it up carefully and you bury it. Bury it so that maybe years down the line from now, the experience of Josiah would be repeated. And that a nation that might be our people and our nation today, having drifted further away from God than they have now, that somebody might dig up that Bible and it would have the effect on them as the law of Moses had upon Josiah, and it would be the means the Lord might use to bring our nation and our people down the line back to himself. That's just setting the scene with Josiah and Zephaniah, who came and ministered to the people in that day. Who was he then? And all I want to do is go through chapter 1 tonight. Who was this man Zephaniah? We're given the very beginning of it, the chapter and the book, a very traditional start to his prophecy. The word of the Lord came to Zephaniah. But the way in which it is put there brings us right at the very beginning that this is no ordinary message. This is not the word of a man or of a prophet. This is the word of the Lord. And Zephaniah is seeking right at the very beginning to establish his source, his authority, his credibility for the message that he's going to bring to these people. And he's doing it because of that long silence in the days of Manasseh and the 2 years of Amon. A long period of quietness, of darkness, and of gross sin against God. And therefore he's coming and he's saying, God is now speaking. This is not my word, it is his word. And therefore he says, later on in verse 7, hold your peace. Perhaps we could put it a lot more forcibly. Be quiet. Silence. God is now speaking. Therefore, listen to what he is saying. That's the same kind of authoritative message we need in our society today likewise. We may not have gone down the same road as Manasseh took his people, but certainly there are factors and features about life then are applied and applicable and seen in life today. And the need of that day and the need of our day is very much the same, that the word of the Lord go out again amongst us, that the word of the Lord be seen not to be the message of a minister, of a church, of a sect, or of any other gatherings of men, but that this message be seen for what it is, the word of the Lord to the people of Zephaniah's day, and that we would have the same relevant message for our people today. What was his name? His name was Zephaniah. Zephaniah means the one whom the Lord hid. And perhaps Zephaniah had a very pious father. And especially living as they would have been living in the days of Manasseh and of the persecution of all things Christian underneath the initial years of Manasseh's reign at least, then perhaps it was Zephaniah's father who sought to do just that for Zephaniah, hide him away until the appropriate time of effectiveness came near. The one whom the Lord hid. Zephaniah's roots And especially we can see that thinking and action when you see who the forefathers of Zephaniah were. We're given here an extended genealogy of him, not like others. Here we have Zephaniah going back four generations. And it is specifically and particularly to establish that he comes from royal blood. He is a man who is well connected. He is a man who is a member of the extended royal family. And as such, he can speak as an insider. He can speak from one who's got a broad view and perception of society, who was able to be in touch with the grassroots and many things that were going on. And therefore, when he says and he speaks something, he knows what and he knows who he is talking about. Go down to verse 8 and you find that coming out. And it shall come to pass in the day of the Lord's sacrifice that I will punish the princes and the king's children. We'll explain what these mean. But here is Zephaniah looking at a very broad picture of the upper echelons of society then and what they were doing and how they were living. And he's coming with a word of judgment against them. And it's a word that is relevant because he knows what they were like. He is bringing his message, God's message, to them in the days of Josiah. We can move over. We know much, at least we know a little about Josiah and the way in which he ruled. Going back again to 2 Chronicles chapter 34, you find that when he was 18 years of age, he found this copy of the law, and it was instrumental in the things that Josiah did. Many people are of the opinion and the mind that guidance was given to Josiah, perhaps by Zephaniah, perhaps by Jeremiah. But there was guidance given to this man in spiritual forms and in the ways that he lived. But again, a simple lesson we can take for ourselves. The courage that was needed, yes, the boldness that was needed, but see what that one person was able to do, the reforms that he brought about. The way in which guidance was given, the way in which encouragement was given from one to another, and the way in which that other achieved so much. We don't know who we might be speaking to. We don't know what might be in front of them or what they might have to do subsequent. But if we can give a little bit of encouragement, just as Zephaniah, Jeremiah and other counselors gave to Josiah, if we're able to give that same counsel to others, they might be able to do much more effective public ministry than we can. They might be able to go out and to do a lot more, just like Josiah did, underneath the teaching of the likes of Zephaniah. Who he was an insider. He was one of the royal family. He was a person of influence in a degree with those who were sitting upon the throne. Well, if that's who he was, what did he say? What was his message? Right away at the beginning at verse 2 and onwards, he says, I will utterly consume all things. Other translations say, I will sweep away all things. Judgment is the main theme of this first chapter of Zephaniah. And he starts the way he means to continue. He challenges, goes right to the very center of the problem of his day. He goes right to the center of their problem, their commitment or their lack of it to the Lord. They were preoccupied, they were bloated and blotted by state paganism. They were a warped people. Verses 4 and 5. I will also stretch out my hand upon Judah and upon all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and I will cut off the remnant of Baal from this place. They were preoccupied, they were besotted by that idolatry. Verse 6. And them that are turned back from the Lord, and those that have not sought the Lord nor inquired of him, they were unconcerned about religion. Religion didn't cross their mind, it didn't influence their lives. When problems came, they sought to solve them themselves. They were unconcerned over God, responsibility, or accountability. Verse 12. And it shall come to pass at that time that I will search Jerusalem with candles and punish the men that are settled on their lees, that say in their heart, the Lord will not do good, neither will he do evil. They had a utterly false idea and picture, understanding of God. They constructed God, or their God, in their own image, and they wanted God to be compliant to their own will and wish. Somebody who was there just out of sight, who wasn't interfering or interested in their life at all. He won't do good, he won't do evil, he's irrelevant for life today. That's the kind of society to which Zephaniah ministered. And he wants to bring before them stark reality, how the realization of just how far they have strayed, how far they've gone away from God. And he wants to bring home to them particularly the consequences of that kind of behavior. We know what Manasseh did. We know the kind of life and ministry that he engaged in, the way in which he made the streets of the city run with the blood. He saw what testimony his father had, Hezekiah had, the way in which Hezekiah was a believer and sought to establish religion in the land, but because of it the Assyrians made life difficult for Hezekiah. And Manasseh saw it. And Manasseh saw what standing for the Lord meant and brought, and he was going to have none of it. And therefore he sought to overthrow, to remove and to blot out, he thought and sought to be as compliant with the Assyrians as it was possible. Anything for an easy life. Later on, much later on in his life, he was brought to realize what awful things he had done. But by then the damage had been done. Into that kind of environment, therefore, Zephaniah speaks of judgment. Of a God who will not compromise with evil. Of a God who is not silent, but a God who acts. And there is nobody exempt from that. God will utterly sweep away man and beast. Remove them from the face of the earth. The ideas and the pictures that are composed by these words in verses 4 and 5, they bring before these people, as they might do to ourselves, a picture of the flood and the way in which the land was swept and cleaned out by the flood. When the evil of the land rose as a fearful smell in the nostrils of God. That's the similar attitude and atmosphere here, that God will consume things away. But it's even more, not only is it that thorough in the sense of sweeping the decks clean, but it's even more extensive than the flood itself. Here in verse 3 he says, and he will consume not only the fowls of the heaven, but the very fish of the sea. That did not happen in the flood, but it is going to happen here. That shows to us how thorough and how extensive this work is going to be. There's no escape then, no escape now. And it goes on, verse 3, and the stumbling blocks with the wicked, and I will cut off man from the land, saith the Lord. This stumbling blocks with the wicked, it's difficult for some people to translate it. It's a phrase that many stumble over. It's best to understand it simply as society is reduced to a pile of rubble or rubbish. Stumbling blocks. That's what it means. A pile of rubble or rubbish. And that's the way the Lord looked on society then. And that's the way the Lord was going to deal with that society then also. As a pile of rubbish just simply swept away. That's the note of judgment that is struck here by the Lord. Now it is perhaps a lesson we can take from that for ourselves in our society today. It's never easy to know where we can start in having a point of contact with people today who have no respect of God, who are ignorant of God. How do you speak to somebody that we meet on the street today? How do you speak to them on spiritual things? They have no respect. They're besotted with society and what the society offers them. They can very easily fit into the description that Zephaniah gives and makes here. What do we say? Well, I think that Zephaniah gives us a good indication. As he began with judgment upon them, so perhaps, that's the way we need to speak to others. That certainly was the way the Lord spoke, and that was the message of the New Testament church. The reality of judgment. Even where there is severe suppression and opposition, even where there is this fearful darkness enshrouding society, we still have a point of contact with the conscience of individuals. We still have a point of contact. It might be a very narrow one and a weak one and a feeble one, but it's there. Only if the conscience is totally dead and totally numb do they become devils, but not yet. And therefore we have that point of contact in the conscience, just like Zephaniah spoke of judgment to them. But then we move on. That's what he said. Yes, he was going to consume man and beast. But then we come to verse 4. And we see there the way in which the people of Judah could well have pled, "We're NIMBYs. Not in my backyard. It's, yes, fine to start sweeping the decks with other nations, but not with us." Remember the way in which Amos starts in that same way and identifies and lists different nations that God is going to enter into judgment with. And we could almost see them all sitting there and enjoying what was being said because it's coming to others. They all become very comfortable. But then Zephaniah turns the gaze from the impersonal and the general, and he says very specifically, "I also will stretch out my hand upon Judah and Jerusalem." Zephaniah shatters this thinking of the exclusivity of the nation. God is going to stretch out his hand upon Judah. Stretching out the hand of God, we've seen it, noted it many times in the past. We can see that as an indication of God's power and the application of God's strength in a very effective and an irresistible way. We see it especially in the way in which the Lord stretched out his hand to save his people out of Egypt, and we can see it in either saving, redeeming, protecting, preserving God's people. But that very same strength and image of God's hand stretched out is also used here in the application of judgment. When you go back to the division of the kingdom, 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 13, there you find the promise, or at least the allusion is made, yes, the Lord would save one nation. He would save one tribe. He would save Judah for David's sake. There they were set aside, sacrosanct. There they were given this exception, this promise of survival. And they latched onto it and they held onto it. And they says, God won't destroy us because of 1 Kings 11:13. But they did not realize that with these covenant privileges, that also brings covenant responsibilities. They needed to be obedient people. committed people, devoted people, and they weren't. And just the very same way as Amos says it at the very beginning, he says, oh yes, look at all them, and now look at you. And he says in chapter 3, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. You are the ones that I've entered into a covenant with. You are the ones that I've given these promises to, these privileges to. You are the ones that have received so much of my revelation and my commitment and my interest. God is speaking to them and he says, you only have I known. Therefore, these privileges bring fearful weights. That's what is happening here with Zephaniah. There was a brazen, there was a gross defiance of God and of the worship of God. There was people that were, we have it listed here, there were the cutting off of the remnant of Baal, the names of the priests, the worship of the heavens. There was those that make them swear by Moloch, those that turned back from the Lord. There was a whole list of things that Zephaniah is listing that indicates just the way in which society has gone bad to worse. And in the light of all these things, all of them rising up before God, Zephaniah says, in the light of them all, verse 7, hold your peace. Be quiet. The Lord is now going to act. The day of the Lord is at hand. It's near. The day of the Lord that he's going to describe more fully in verse 14 and onwards. And the way in which it's described here, it's fearful. The Lord has prepared a sacrifice. You think of a sacrifice as of a goat, a bullock, a lamb. But that's not what is meant here. What is meant here is a sacrifice, yes, and who is the sacrifice? The people are the sacrifice. They are the ones that are the object of the Lord's displeasure. And it goes on. He hath bid his guests. The Lord has invited guests, and they're coming. And who are the ones that are coming? They are these nations round about who will be oppressing his people. They are the ones, a nation with a mission. And they're going to start at the royal house. In the same day, I will punish them. I will punish the princes and the king's children and all such as are clothed with strange apparel. Who's he referring to? The princes? He's referring, let's first of all say, he's not referring to Josiah. When he speaks about the princes, he's talking about some of the officials that were backing up or behind Josiah, but who had not been affected or changed like Josiah had been. Or the king's sons here refers to the wider circle and realm of the royal family as you have it today. The same applied then. You've got the large entourage of royalty coming on the coattails of the king. And they were just simply there, followers of fashion, dressing up to be admired and attracted and pleased and worshipped by those who were going on round about them. That's what was important to them, not the inner disposition of heart and soul. And then it comes to verse 9. In the same day also will I punish all those that leap on the threshold, which fill the master's houses with violence and deceit. Some see this as a reference to Dagon in 1 Samuel 5:5. Not standing on the threshold, but that's a very local thing, a very isolated thing, and it cannot be exported into verse 9. What it means here in verse 9 is those that leap on the threshold, simply those that are so keen to get wealth by whatever deceitful means, they're so keen to make a buck for their master that they just simply jump over the threshold into the opportunity of that house, that place, whatever it is, they're in there making their money for their master. goes on to speak about those who are in the marketplace, ye inhabitants of Makesh. In verse 11, that's the marketplace. It's like a pestle and mortar. It's like a mortar, it's like a bowl. And in that bowl is where the market was taking place. And that was the very center of all the deceit and all the evil that was going on in that society. People that were bartering for gold and such like, and silver, such like, they're all going to be cut down. That's what this verse is speaking about. There's going to be a crying out at the fish gate. There shall be a cry from the fish gate, and an howling from the second quarter, a deep, deep, intense cry of suffering. The same kind of suffering and the same kind of cry that came from the children of Israel when they were oppressed by the Egyptians. The kind of wailing that comes for the dead. And it's going to be such a pronounced noise in the city that it's going to echo off the hills that are round about. Not only that, but we're told here that the Lord is going to light a candle and he's going to search out Jerusalem. The houses in these days were very narrow windows to keep them cool. And because of that, they were quite dim and dark inside. And it needed a light quite early, if not the whole of the day. And it needed a light in the place. And therefore, we have the image here of the Lord taking a candle and going in and searching every single corner. Searching out not only thoroughly, not only extensively, but exhaustively. Going through with a clear search for the sins and the evil of that nation. It's not a glance and passed over. It's a close inspection. They were like wine left on the lees. The men had settled on their lees. That's what it said in verse 12. They became comfortable in their complacency. God isn't going to do anything about this. We can just carry on business as usual. The day after, the day after, the day after. That's what they've been like. Settled on the lees. We know what Jeremiah says in Moab in verse chapter 48, 11. Moab has not been turned, it's not been disturbed, hasn't been turned over. The same is true here about these people. They haven't been disturbed. They've been left as they were. The wine has just settled. Settled, settled. And that has bred complacency. They've gone from bad to worse. And they thought that their quiet life, in their quiet life, it didn't matter what they lived or how they behaved, God wasn't going to act. And then there is this fearful message that shatters everything. That day is a day of wrath and a day of trouble. The great day of the Lord is near. Verse 14 to the end. The day of the Lord. Joel mentions it. Amos mentions it. Obadiah mentions it. Zechariah mentions it. Zephaniah mentions it. It's a recurring theme through all of these prophets. It's near. And that's the very point that Zephaniah is seeking to make to these people. They thought God wasn't going to act. And he's coming and he says, oh yes, God will. And God is going to act. He shatters the thinking of these people. And God is going to act in a very dramatic way. The reference perhaps people draw it mainly from the battle of Gideon and the way in which Gideon had fought. Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 4. The action, especially with the Lord intervening so that there was no doubt where the source of the victory came. It was just a handful of people and had such a tremendous victory that it was the action was clearly fixed and focused upon God at work. The day of the Lord, the day of the Midianites' defeat. That's the illusion, a military victory without any human resources, without any dependence on numbers. It was God who was acting on behalf of his people. So that's the first thing that comes out about the day of the Lord. It is God who's going to act in a very clear and a very dramatic way. But the second thing about the day of the Lord that these people then concluded was that this meant deliverance for themselves. If the Lord is going to act in that way against the enemies of his people, that's us, that means that we will then be delivered. There is this intervention by God, and it's going to bring great rejoicing for us. But they misunderstood what the day of the Lord meant. The day of the Lord was for, yes, an unmistakable intervention, but it was for God's purpose, and it was for God's vindication of his name. Certainly not for the comfort of his people, especially if they were complacent and compliant and comfortable in their sin. These people were his people. God required their commitment and their allegiance. And if they didn't produce it, the Lord was going to come, as we're told here, in a day of his wrath, to promote it and to bring it forth from them. He will act to correct them and to draw them closer to himself. We're told, yes, there is going to be a day of wrath when the rage of God is against sin. There is going to be, when that day comes, an emotional effect upon the people. There's going to be distress, there's going to be anguish, there's going to be concern. There's going to be physical trouble, there's going to be ruin. There's going to be darkness, there's going to be gloom. There is going to be a disaster upon the people. They're going to be like blind men. That's what we're told here. I will bring distress upon men that they shall walk like blind men. The Lord acting to correct his people. And he says it clearly. We said, I'm starting in the way I'm finishing. Judgment. So therefore at the very end of this first chapter, notice what he says in verse 17. What's the reason for it all? Because they have sinned against the Lord. Simple, but a serious explanation. You cannot get out of it. You cannot avoid it. If the hat fits, wear it. It's the badge that describes their life. They treated God indifferently. They thought they could take or leave what God is, what God has said. They thought that they could write God off, that they could go after their own agenda and follow their own interests. They thought they could play footloose and fancy free with covenant requirements and God's requirements upon them. And God is now breaking into their lifestyle. And God is rattling their cage. And God is speaking to them through the prophet Zephaniah, and he's saying, I am not silent, and I will not be still. The day of the Lord is coming when I will vindicate my name, when I will have the glory to myself, when people will see his holiness, when he will restore his people to himself. The day of the Lord, it points forward to the very final event. The day of the Lord is like when you're climbing a hill and you get over one ridge, you think that ridge is the top, and then you get there and you see another one beyond it, and you climb up and there's another one beyond it, and you keep on going up these several ridges, each one of them getting you closer to the top. It's the same with the teaching that's given about the day of the Lord until you get to the final one, Malachi 4 and verse 5. Malachi 4 and verse 5. I will send my precursor. I will send my servant before you, Elijah. And Elijah is going to speak about the final day of the Lord, the cross. There clearly the Lord is at work. There clearly his holiness is displayed. There clearly his name is vindicated. There clearly God's purpose is fulfilled. He is the sinner's hope. He is the sinner's Savior. He is the one who will bring his people from darkness, from sin, from all of these things and much more on top that Zephaniah has been describing his society that we find through of our society today. God is the one who will redeem his people and take them to himself when that final day of the Lord comes, the day of the cross. It's a day of darkness to begin with. But not long thereafter, there's the joy of the resurrection. And so we'll find as we go through this, yes, there's a word of judgment here. But go into chapter 2 and 3, and we'll find not only repentance, but rejoicing also. But that is for another day.